welcome everybody. Okay, it's great having bell ringers. I'm glad that they were able to bring everybody in. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas. Unitarian Universalism has no creed. We have no prophet that we follow ahead of all others. And we have no sacred book. Instead, as Melissa Harriet Perry, who is a host on the MSNBC, says, we are committed to being together and to being together in ways that respect our principles. Our worship and our work exist in finding practical and nurturing ways to govern ourselves and our congregations by living out our commitment to openness, the democratic process, human equality, social justice, and personal exploration. That's the end of her quote. The seven principles around which we meet are on the back page of your order of service. These seven principles are we ascribe to beliefs in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another, and encouragement of our members' spiritual growth, a free and responsible search for truth and for meaning, the right of conscience and use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, and respect for the interdependent web of all life and all existence, of which we are a part, but only a part. So welcome to the UU Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas, where we can explain, debate, discuss, and challenge all that we meet about these seven guiding principles. As is practiced in thousands of UU fellowships around the world, we open our service this morning with the lighting of the chalice, and I have three wonderful chalice volunteers with. Okay, so we have two volunteers and one observer. Okay. From the words of the Reverend Bill Gupton, and he was holding a coffee mug that had these words on them as he said them. So these are from a coffee mug. So we have two lighters, one observer, and one government worker. Okay, our flame, with which we light our chalice, is a symbol of transcendence and truth. Truth triumphing over the dark forces of superstition and of fear. Our circle of the chalice proclaims that the earth and all its inhabitants are one. From the common container of this chalice, we share the warmth of our fellowship with all. At this point, the UU choir is going to sing an anthem, but in lieu of an anthem, Michael Oldfather will address the crowd.
We just didn't have enough voices to do justice to a very beautiful anthem, and the stars will be with the traveler some other Sunday, not too far into the future. Also, want to announce that Slavomir leaving after he plays the offertory is no reflection on the program or anything else. He is playing the orchestra part for a performance of a Rachmaninoff piano concerto at 3 o'clock in the Kermser auditorium at campus. Might also mention that he is giving his faculty recital 7:30 on Tuesday. In All Faiths Chapel, lots of really wonderful music.
And those announcements were in the key of G. This is the portion of the program in which we give announcements. Most of the announcements are written in the back of the program, but I was brought three announcements that I'll read to you that are not in the program. The first one is about Turnaround Tuesday. This was brought to me by Ann Cowan. The Turnaround Tuesdays are held each Tuesday, obviously, at the Kansas State Statehouse at 5:30 p.m. It's sponsored by the Topeka Peace and the Topeka Congregational Church. It's a short program. This Tuesday's topic is Medicaid expansion in Kansas. So if anybody wants to ride, please see Ann Cowan. The second announcement is the Vegan Society of Manhattan, Kansas, is hosting a meeting at the Manhattan Public Library today, Sunday, at 4 p.m., and meeting in the meeting room, the Grosbeck? Grosbeck meeting room, and everybody is welcome, vegan or otherwise. And then the third announcement is the Communications Committee, and this one I need to put my glasses on because it's in a smaller font. The Communications Committee is happy to announce that they have a new way to continue conversations about services, discuss ideas for new services, and share information about events and happenings in the community. And it's all on Facebook. The UFM Coffee and Conversations Group sponsors a Facebook account. The Facebook account is secret, which means a post can only be seen by members of the group, and no one else can see that you are a member, except for Google, I imagine. But it's not secret. We want everyone in the UUFM community who wants to be a part of it to be a part of it. If you're on Facebook, you may already have been added to the group by one of your Facebook friends. If you don't want to be part of it, please opt out of the membership in the UUFM Facebook account and leave the group. But we hope it becomes a lively place for all who are members to be a closer community. If you want to get on to the Facebook account or want more information, see Amy Fowler. Amy, you want to raise your hand? Hey, Amy's back there. Mike Bonella. Is Mike here?
No.
He's not here. Okay, so don't see Mike today. Or Scott, right here. I think that was all three announcements. Right now is the time for cares and concerns and joys of members of the fellowship. We welcome you to share the burden of your concerns with others in this sharing, caring community, as well as permit us to share with you any joys that have touched your life. Please wait for the microphone so everybody can hear.
Dick and Judy Cattell, and we are celebrating our 63rd wedding anniversary today.
Yeah. Now, was that a joy or a concern?
Congratulations. Our concern is Michaela and Jessica's godmother is at Mercy with some difficulties after major surgery, so we have our best of hopes for her.
Good morning, Sandy Nelson. I had a great joy for weeks, actually. We celebrated our oldest daughter, Allison's, marriage last night here in this building, and it was awesome. And I wanted to thank personally everyone who just gave so much support and volunteered their time to help in the kitchen, Jane and Scott and Kathleen and Amanda and Molly and Amy, and I probably missed somebody. And everybody who set up the chairs again this morning after we hauled tables out. And it was a lovely event, and I just wanted to say thank you very much.
Ready for all the concerns?
Shoot, one more?
Oh, okay, great.
Grandma Nelson.
I'd like to emphasize what Sandy said. I'm here from California. The warmth and caring and concern and just care that I experience every time I come to this church is a great feeling of community, and I thank you all. I'm taking back all your ideas to my own church. And I wanted to tell you that it's very obvious that your church also has an active RE program, just like ours does, because when I went to search for a Band-Aid, all the children-sized bandages were gone. So.
Montemani, I'd like to thank Mark Mosier and Matt Campbell for providing manpower to help us get the bees out of here. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, for all the joys and all the concerns left unspoken, know that this community offers love and support. All the children like to come forward? Does this work? Are we live? Okay. This is one of Aesop's fables. Oops. This is one of Aesop's fables. Have any of you heard of Aesop before? Okay. He wrote a lot of fables, or at least a lot of fables are attributed to him. He was born about 2,600 years ago, a long, long, long time ago. He was born a slave in ancient Greece, and upon the death of his masters, he was given his legal freedom. And he consequently traveled far and wide throughout the known world at the time, which was smaller than the known world today. But he is welcome in many, many circles because of his wit and because of the observations he made on his travels. One of the things that he's known for is his fables. And today's fable has to do with the lion, this ferocious lion. Unfortunately, he's not looking very ferocious, but it's the closest I could come. This ferocious lion and a mouse. Is the name of the fable. You know this one? Many of you have probably heard this one before. I have a mouse. Pardon? I didn't bring a net, but I have a rope. And I have a mouse. Here's the mouse. I'm sorry, it's the closest I can come. That's a tale. One day the lion was sleeping in the jungle. Asleep. And a mouse came along, and he noticed the lion was asleep. And he thought, oh, this is a great opportunity. And so he kind of crawled up the lion's back leg, and he crawled up the lion's back, and he crawled around to the ear. And if somebody's crawling on you when you're asleep, generally you wake up. So that's what happened in this case. Now he's right around in here when the lion woke up and said, what are you doing? And he put his big paw on top of the mouse. And he was about to open his big jaws and swallow the mouse. And the mouse said, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Mr. Lion. I will never do this again. I will never bother you if you just let me go. I will come and do you a favor one of these days if you let me go. That's the closest I can come to a mouse voice. And the lion was so tickled with this story of the mouse helping the ferocious lion that, for one thing, he held his stomach and did a few belly laughs, and then he let the mouse go. Okay, you come back someday and help me. Ha, 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 ha. So the mouse quickly runs away, and the lion goes about doing his liony things. Well, a few days later, the lion was prancing around the jungle, and he gets caught in a trap. Some hunters come, and they captures the lion. And the hunters think, well, this is such a great gift. Oops, I need both of them, actually. This is such a great gift for the king to bring him a ferocious lion. So the hunters go off. I didn't bring any hunters. The hunters go off to find a wagon to carry the lion to the king. And while the lion is stuck, tied to the tree, while the hunters are looking for a wagon, along comes the mouse. And he kind of eyes the situation and said, that's the same lion that helped me. Or let me go. So I'm going to do him a favor as well. So the mouse comes up to the lion, and he starts gnawing on the rope that the hunters tied him to the tree with. And eventually, by gnawing on that rope, the lion was freed. And the lion was freed, and he said, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. And the mouse says, see, I told you I'd come back and do you a good deed. Now, Aesop had a lot of morals with his stories. What do you think the moral of this story is? That's one. That's a very good moral. Right. That's exactly the version I had, too. Okay, little friends can really be great friends in the future. And that's what happened here with the mouse and the lion. Now, there's another story, and because we're running, we have plenty of time, according to Dick here. Another story that's very related to Aesop's fables that was written about 2,600 years ago. How many of you have seen Les Miserables? Which is a big musical production. It was a novel written by Victor Hugo that's about this thick, and you'll probably read a chapter or two of it in high school. I had to. You guys, I hope you have to. Les Miserables. But in that, in that story, there's a little boy, and the little boy helps out the revolutionaries in France in 1848. And he points out, just like the mouse did, that even though we're small, we can help out a lot. So one of the songs that the little boy, Gavroche, sings ties in directly to the Aesop's fable. And I'm going to look at the words of this one to make sure I get it right. So one of the words he sings, or some of the words he sings as part of this song is, and I'll try not to sing it because I don't have a voice, a worm, a little tiny worm, can roll a stone. A bee can sting a bear. A fly can fly around Versailles because a fly doesn't care. A sparrow in a hat can make a happy home. And this one I kind of decided whether or not I should read it or not, but, and a flea can bite the bottom of the Pope in Rome. A little tiny flea can bother somebody so big and so august as the Pope in Rome. So the moral of Gavroche's story, which is the name of the song, is this only goes to show what little people can do. So go to your RE, and I wouldn't suggest any flea-like biting, but go and remember that you are all part of this fellowship.
Oh, so now,
Slavomir will provide the meditation as we pass the basket so all of you can share with those who need some help.
Good morning. I'm Dick Beeman, and I will be introducing and interviewing our Baha'i representative today. But first, the way we're going to do this is that I'm going to give you a very brief outsider perspective on Baha'i, and then our expert is going to come up and correct me, set us straight, and I'll interview her, and you'll have plenty of time to ask your own questions. But let me start with my very brief outsiders, and this is going to be a very selective, incomplete view, just some reflections that I had while studying Baha'i over the last couple of weeks on their very excellent website and also talking with Sue about it. The couple of things really struck me when I was studying up on Baha'i the last couple of weeks. The first is that it's an amazingly progressive religion, a lot of very progressive ideas, especially considering that it emerged from Shia Islam in the early part of the 19th century in Persia. And then the other thing that struck me is that those very progressive ideas of Baha'i are kind of interwoven with some very traditional and conservative ideas that seem incompatible with a lot of the progressive ideas, and I'm sure that some of those will come up and Sue can give us her perspective on those. So the overriding principle of Baha'i, as far as I can tell, is unity and inclusiveness. And when wrongs or wounds are inflicted on you, I should feel them, not just spiritually, but I should feel them viscerally, almost physically. I've written down some principles of Baha'i. These aren't the official, seven principles, but these are seven things that struck me as I was studying. So these are incomplete, gleaned from my readings. And a lot of the wording is taken from the very excellent online resources about Baha'i. Number one, there are no false religions. All major religions come from God. Baha'i do not regard theirs as the one true religion. And as an aside, I'll just speak very authoritatively, even though I don't know what I'm talking about. Sue, you feel free to correct everything I say that's wrong. Baha'i do not regard theirs as the one true religion, but rather as the most recent in an ongoing series of progressive revelations that includes all the major religions of the world. So properly understood, the religions of the world are not in conflict with each other, but rather they're all facets of a single divine truth. Two, there's only one human race. The goal of a peaceful and just global society demands that we overcome all prejudice, whether based on race, religion, or economic status. Baha'i supports the strengthening of the UN and advocates a single world government and even a universal world language eventually. Principle number three, celebrate diversity. A lot of these are going to sound familiar. Unity, again, is the overriding Baha'i principle, but unity is not the same as uniformity. Diversity and unity do not conflict with each other. They do not exclude each other, just the opposite. How much more beautiful and interesting, goes one of the Baha'i readings that I found, how much more beautiful and interesting is a garden whose flowers differ in kind, color, form, and shape. Four, women and men are equal. The emancipation of women is a prerequisite for world peace. The rational soul has no gender. If education funds are limited in any impoverished region of the world, then the education of women, and especially of girls, must have top priority. Five, science and religion must always be in harmony. Reality is the only truth. Any religious belief that conflicts with scientific truth is either superstition or a misinterpretation of the religious teachings as revealed by the messenger or the prophet. More on that later. But science without moral, spiritual, and religious development leads to materialism. Six, economic justice. This one's really interesting. Economic justice is a prerequisite for the unity of humankind. There must be an assured minimum income guaranteed by public institutions that ensures that the basic needs for human well-being are met. Not only that, but there should be an absolute maximum income level that would prevent extreme accumulation of wealth in any one individual. Seven, every individual should engage in an independent search for truth. If you fail to use your God-given intellect to question opinions and ideas out of fear or authority or out of adulation of authority, fear of authority or out of adulation of authority, then you are neglecting your moral duty as a human being. So that's just a brief sort of biased, incomplete introduction. Now, I'm going to introduce Sue Haas. Sue is a native Kansan. Born in Kansas City, Kansas. She spent a lot of her early adult years out of state, but then she came back to Kansas in 1979 to get a master's degree in entomology at Kansas State. That's the same year Sylvie and I came to Manhattan also. And I've known Sue for, I don't know, 25 or 30 years, I forget, Sue. And she and I were co-workers for many long years at the USDA Grain Research Lab, from which we're now both retired. So I got to know her very well, although I don't think we ever discussed religion. She actually did give a program on Baha'i about, I don't know, 20 years ago, Sue, here at this fellowship. And I have to confess that I've forgotten everything about it, so whatever we hear is going to be new to me. What else can I say? She got a master's in entomology, so she's another entomologist. She's been a Baha'i for many years. I don't think that she's a Baha'i by birth, Sue. I assume not. And so she's going to maybe tell us a little bit about how she came to be a Baha'i. So now I would like to bring Sue Haas up here, and we'll sit and I'll interview her, and she'll set me straight and she'll set us straight. All right, Sue, you heard what I just said.
Yes.
How far off base was I? Well, what is Baha'i all about? What do Baha'is believe?
A lot of what you said is right on the money. As a matter of fact, when Dick emailed me his response that he was going, or his introduction he was giving here, I teasingly told him, well, maybe he should give the lecture, the talk this morning on the Baha'i faith, because what he had was so good. And the only thing that I heard that I think might be a little off is as far as the extremes of wealth, there might be. It's, what should I say, the method as to how they're to be carried out. hasn't been formulated exactly yet. That's for future development.
Right. They must have a lot of principles that they think, you know, we'll figure out how to do this in the future, right?
Right. The one thing as far as amassing or people with much wealth, it said that it's preferable if people who are very wealthy voluntarily give of their wealth to where it's needed, to the poor. Everything else that you said there is pretty much right on the money.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's a start as to the description of what Baha'is believe.
Right.
I mentioned briefly that Baha'i originated in the 1900s in Persia, but could you give us a little more information on the origin of Baha'i? I know it came out of Shia Islam, but it has nothing to do with Islam, right? It's not similar to Islam.
Right. It came out of the roots and the culture of Islam in the same way that Christianity came out of the roots of Judaism. Mm-hmm. But as Christianity is not a sect of Judaism, so the Baha'i faith is not a sect of Islam. It began in 1844, and there were actually what we consider twin prophets. There was the first one in 1844, and Baha'u'llah, which means glory of God, who is the prophet the Baha'is follow, was an adherent of the Bab, which means the gate. Because of Shia Islam, the Bab eventually, well, there were, quite a following began, which upset the Shia clergy, and ultimately...
The Bab was a person or a...
A person, okay. The Bab, yeah. Right. And a number of Baha'is were executed, a number of Babis were executed early on, and after about eight years after that, the Babi faith began. Baha'u'llah had an insight that he was the next one, so a twin manifestation, twin prophet. Similar to, well, in the Christian faith, of course, John the Baptist preceded and kind of announced Christ, but John the Baptist isn't looked upon as a separate prophet or messenger, but Baha'u'llah is. And initially, the clergy, again, in Persia were uncomfortable with the popularity that the Baha'i faith was gaining under Baha'u'llah. And so they had him exiled to the Ottoman Turk Empire. Originally, he was in Tehran, which is where he was born. And then his family and a number of followers were exiled to Constantinople and then to Adrianople. And finally to Akka, which it was a prison penal colony city on the sea, which, you know, is now Israel. Remained there for the rest of Baha'u'llah's life. At first in the prison barracks, and his whole family was there under horrible conditions. And then they were allowed to, you know, go elsewhere in the city. And ultimately they were allowed to go outside the city and, you know, found housing outside the city, which made it a lot easier for believers and people interested in the faith from all over the world to come visit him there. And so that is where his grave is, where the house, the mansion is where they moved into, because at the time, and this is just one of these random factors, things that happen, when they were said they could go outside the city, as it turns out, I guess there was some kind of small plague in the area, and the rich family or man who had the mansion built got scared and just abandoned it and, you know, split. And so the Baha'is in the area inquired and made arrangements, and they were able to acquire it and use it. So that is kind of a Baha'i historical center now.
Yeah, and so he was kind of in house arrest in sort of a mansion. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, they were not allowed to go elsewhere. They were not released to travel internationally or travel anywhere. But still, it was much more comfortable circumstances, definitely than their first place in Akka.
And I suppose that by the end of his life, he had a significant following, and the Persian authorities weren't very successful at stifling him, apparently, because he got
exactly. And little by little, when Baha'u'llah, his son Abdul Baha, which means servant of the glory, worked very closely with his father, and helped cultivate the Baha'i community that was growing, the nascent Baha'i community. And after Baha'u'llah passed on in the late 1800s, he left a will and testament appointing specifically Abdul Baha as, what should I say, the interpreter of his writings. And this was to avoid schism, because so many times in past religions, once the originator of the religion, the messenger, dies, ultimately schisms develop because of various interpretations or misinterpretations of the original writings. And so this did not happen. There was a smooth transition from the messenger to Abdul Baha, whose title was the exemplar, because he was not a prophet or messenger of God, but he is looked upon as the person who's the epitome of how you can serve humanity and the Baha'i faith with humility and constancy and dedication. And you'd have to just read more about him. And ultimately, one of his grandsons, Shoghi Effendi, that I don't think that means anything in Persian, as far as I know, that's just his name, was very close to Abdul Baha. And ultimately, when Abdul Baha passed, he left a will and testament appointing Shoghi Effendi as the interpreter of the writings, mm-hmm. the Baha'i faith.
So this was the grandson of the originator of
Baha'u'llah. The great-grandson.
Great-grandson?
Yeah. And Shoghi Effendi is responsible for cultivating and helping develop the administrative order of the Baha'i faith that was referred to in the original writings of Baha'u'llah. He helped bring them to fruition.
Okay.
And that began, there were Baha'is, ultimately Abdul Baha. In 1911, the Young Turks revolt and the Ottoman Empire was no longer as such, they were allowed to travel. And in 1911 and 1912, Abdul Baha traveled to Europe. In 1912, he traveled to the United States and Canada. And as a matter of fact, in 1912, Abdul Baha addressed in Washington, D.C., the Universalist Church, which is part of the heritage, of the church, Universalist UU church that you have here. So Shoghi Effendi helped develop the administrative bodies in the various communities around the world. And the administrative bodies are at the local level. There's the local spiritual assembly, which nine adult members in any community form the administrative body of the local spiritual assembly. At the national level, there's the national spiritual assembly, and each is nine members. There's nine members. And after Shoghi Effendi's death, ultimately he had put things in motion and in place such that the Universal House of Justice, which is the international governing body of the Baha'i faith, was able to be elected by members of all of the national spiritual assemblies in the whole world. So that's kind of
a worldwide election.
Yes, and that happens every 5 years. The local and national assemblies, in each nation, that's every year.
Well, can I interrupt you at this point to ask about the founder, Baha'u'llah.
Baha'u'llah.
Mm-hmm. He sort of appointed himself as the messenger, right?
In a sense, you could say. He had a revelation, okay. A message from God, an insight that he was the one
to carry. Did he regard himself, and do Baha'i currently regard him, as something like an infallible prophet?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, we regard him in the same way that Christians regard Jesus.
Okay.
You know, he's the prophet for that time in which he came.
Let's see, there's so many questions that occur to me right now, I don't know which direction to go with it.
Go for it, Dick.
One is, let's see, I guess I'll just grab one randomly. This is what I don't quite understand. One of the things I don't quite understand is that Baha'u'llah is an infallible messenger of God. He's sort of, he's human, but he's superhuman in some way. Mm-hmm. He's a special human who is infallible. And yet, a lot of what I read on the Baha'i website talks about that it's everyone's duty to question authority, to personally search for truth. What happens if there's a conflict between, you know, your concept of truth and the writings of Baha'u'llah?
Well, as previous to becoming a Baha'i, every person who is a Baha'i does, you know, a conscientious search of, you know, their conscience and the writings and stuff, and then if they convince themselves that this is true, then they become a Baha'i.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that search for every individual, whether it's Baha'i or non, the purpose is to examine what you believe and why for what you feel is its validity. And that's to avoid just being a member of a given religion because your family has always been, or because you know you'd be more accepted if you are a member in that given society. In other words, it's kind of to avoid hypocrisy in a sense. I don't know, did I kind of get off the track there?
That's a start. let me ask you this. I read on the Baha'i website that the Baha'u'llah, Baha'u'llah did a vast amount of his writing when he was in house arrest in the later part of his life, and he had a tremendous output of writing, letters, books, tremendous output, far greater than the scriptures of Islam or Christianity.
Right.
And I also read something that really amazed me that said only a very small percentage have ever been translated into any other language.
I'm not sure what percentage exactly. The ones that have not yet been translated, and Shoghi Effendi was the one responsible for a lot of translation because he had part of his education in Oxford in England, and so, you know, he was very instrumental in translating into English a lot of, you know, the original writings and things.
Yeah.
There's an archive in Haifa, Israel, where the Universal House of Justice has its buildings and archives. Mm-hmm. And so little by little, you know, things will get translated. I guess as Baha'is, you just... There are certain things that, as I recall in the writings, that will be released as mankind is ready for them.
Hmm.
So,
you mean among his writings that are already written, or
even some of his laws, until as far as say financial obligation to the faith, for many many years, the Western Baha'is were not beholden to observe it. And then finally the Western Baha'is requested to take on that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Little things like that. But the things that are important for building a unified world and developing each person's spiritual life, is there.
Let's see. Well, I'll ask this question now. I don't know a good time to ask it. It might sound rude, but I know you pretty well, and I know that you won't take it. In fact, you told me I could ask you anything.
I'll hold on to my chair.
No, I just wanted to know. I read on the website that the International...
Universal House of Justice.
The House of Justice, which has 9 justices, I think.
Nine members. They're 9. Not justices.
Oh,
it's not as in their... lawyers or anything.
9 members that are elected for a 5-year term, I believe.
Right.
But women are not allowed on that panel.
That's right. The Baha'i Faith teaches equality of men and women. And so this question has come up again and again. You know, Baha'is speculate on it.
Yeah.
As far as what is in the writings of Baha'u'llah, there is no information as to the why of this. Abdu'l-Bahá has commented that the reason for it in time will become as obvious as the sun at high noon, but no details are given. The Universal House of Justice also comments that in the future there will be future administrative bodies, organizations, as mankind matures, that will be created, such as a universal tribunal, and women will be able to serve on that. So why not in the Universal House of Justice?
Mm-hmm.
You can endlessly speculate on that.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite speculation, is that at some time in the future, it will be necessary for the Baha'i Faith at the international level to interact with other organizations in the world, other cultures, to help something important happen. That because of cultural sensitivities of other peoples would not happen if there were women on the Universal House of Justice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not because of any lacking of women, because that is absolutely explicitly clear that men and women are equal. Not exactly the same, but equal in all the rights and privileges and, you know, intelligence.
Maybe an escape route for this dilemma is the idea that revelation is progressive and that some future revelation will update the past revelation.
Very possibly. It could be, you know, because Baha'u'llah teaches that a new prophet or messenger is sent approximately every 1,000 years. Well, you know, it was only 200 years ago or so that, you know, the most recent one in the Baha'i perspective has come. And so in the far future, when the next 1,000 years comes, maybe the next prophet or manifestation or messenger will be a woman.
Okay.
We have no way of knowing.
Okay. Let's see. This is maybe totally off topic, but something I'm curious about. How did you get interested in Baha'i? What is kind of your personal spiritual journey?
In junior high, I first got introduced to it in junior high and early high school. My mother worked at the KU Medical Center, and her supervisor was a Baha'i. And I didn't get any direct information from being around them, you know, at first, but occasionally we would go to their house. You know, they would have people over, and, you know, we'd all have a meal together and stuff. As I grew older, I started noticing little things around their house that I didn't understand, you know, little artifacts of Baha'i and things like that. So finally I asked my mom about it. Says, what are those? She says, oh, they're Baha'i. It's just some kind of religion. And so ultimately I, you know, in getting older and older, and got to the point of where I just decided one time I saw them, I asked them myself, and they gave a brief explanation. I forget which one I talked to. And then they offered, you know, a pamphlet, just some brief literature to satisfy my curiosity. And, you know, I started reading that. And the more I read, the more I wanted to read. And so I got a hold of more stuff. And then I started attending firesides, which are little informal meetings, usually in people's houses, where they invite people who are curious and, you know, talk to them, just kind of like you and I are talking now. And ultimately, I got to the point, and all at the same time, I was also searching around going to a Unitarian, not a Unitarian, Unity School of Christianity Church, and, you know, just exploring. And I finally got to the point where so much of it made sense. I said to myself, this is silly. I believe it all. I should become one. And that's just about exactly what I thought to myself at that point in time. So I did. Mm-hmm. So I just declared myself as a Baha'i. And that was in Kansas City, Kansas, and just became, you know, an active member of that community and any community that I happen to be in since then.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. How do Baha'is promote their religion? I mean, you've got, I think you have 5 million members worldwide, which is about 10 times as many as Unitarians, I believe. How do you promote yourself?
Well, not by proselytizing, because that's something you had asked. We are specifically, I mean, that's in the writings, you are not to proselytize or force the religion on anyone.
No knocking door to door.
No, well, occasionally in the past people have gone door to door to just let people be aware of it and ask if they're interested in, you know, finding out more. But no forcing religion on someone. You've got to believe this, you've got to do this and stuff. Mostly, you know, it's just when it comes up, you know, person to person, provide information, or occasionally Baha'is have booths at like state fairs just to make it known. And then there's, you know, firesides, things like that. But no forcing people, you know, that this is something that you have to convert to type of thing. It's got to be totally a person's following, you know, their intellectual and spiritual own, their own query into it once they find out about it.
Mm-hmm. I understand that, the Baha'i believe in a progressive revelation, the evolution of spirit over long periods of time, and, mm-hmm. and that they sort of envision a future time when everything is perfect and beautiful on Earth. So, right? I mean, they're looking forward to it.
That's a relative term, you know, because mankind will never be perfect.
Yeah.
But things will get progressively mm-hmm. better as we spiritually mature. As mankind spiritually matures.
So they're looking forward to a far better life on Earth, but do you believe in an afterlife as well?
Yes. Baha'is believe that at conception, your spirit is also associated with your body. It's not physically in your body, but it's associated with your body in some way that we're not capable of understanding at this point. And then just as your body grows in the womb of the mother, it develops from, you know, the egg to a whole developed baby, so our spirit develops as we go through this life. And, you know, you can either inhibit its development or promote and facilitate its development, depending on, you know, circumstances and, you know, where you want to go with it, where your awareness will take you.
Mm-hmm. And then what happens in the afterlife?
It is said to be so different from what we are capable of understanding that it would be like a painting, you should be able to get this analogy, Dick, a painting trying to understand the painter. It's literally impossible. So from our environment here, what happens in the next life is so different, I mean, is such a different state of being that it would be impossible for us to conceive of it currently. To follow up on that, Baha'is, instead of believing, you know, the next life is not divided into a heaven or a hell, which, you know, is kind of like maybe an upstairs and a downstairs. The Baha'i afterlife is simply an all-inclusive afterlife that all spirits are in once your body is no longer mm-hmm. part of you. So in a way, it's kind of like a next door instead of an upstairs and a downstairs, I guess would be an analogy.
And then what happens? Does your spirit continue to grow? I mean,
infinitely.
Okay. So even do you believe in evil?
Evil is the absence of good. It's like darkness is the absence of sunlight. It's not a thing in of itself. There's no devil, no evil entity that's going to influence you. Our baser instincts, our animal side of our instincts, when we get into selfishness and that, are an equivalent. I mean, what is our evil side, our dark side, so to speak? And as we become aware of the necessity and follow the path to become more spiritual, we become more enlightened and less dark as humanity and as individuals. Mm-hmm. So it takes striving and awareness.
At this point, I'm going to give the people in the group here an opportunity to ask questions. Fire away at Sue.
I'll try my best to give an answer.
Matt Campbell here. So in the introduction, we learned that Baha'i is fairly open to other religions and believes that there is like one God and all religions are working towards the same thing. So how does that go? So if I am not Baha'i, you know, how flexible inside of Baha'i is your interpretation of the beliefs? So from
interpretation
our
of what?
Interpretation of the Baha'i in particular. Because like a Unitarian or Universalist, our interpretation is very loose. So there's lots of people that are Unitarian Universalists believe different things. So Baha'i allows for other beliefs, but how does that work inside of Baha'i in the belief system?
You mean, how do we look upon others' beliefs?
No, well, I think that's clear, but how... If you are Baha'i, you have to believe these certain things, and how loose of an interpretation of the writings is allowed.
How loose of an interpretation?
Yeah. So if I were to believe something that wasn't in line with the Baha'i writings, is that acceptable or not? Or am I considered something else, and is that still, you know, acceptable?
As an individual, every individual is kind of on a path to seeking truth in one way or another. And wherever your path takes you is your responsibility to explore. If a person gets to the point of, you know, say one of the things they've explored is the Baha'i faith, then and become enthused about it enough to think maybe I should become one, your obligations are to accept the teachings once you get to that point. And to try your best at any given point in time to live up to them. That's just kind of those twin obligations. As a non-Baha'i, you know, your path is how you choose it. There's Baha'is don't look upon non-Baha'is as anything lesser than they are. We're simply all human beings taking our spiritual paths where we feel we need to. Okay.
John Extel. So Baha'i arose in the area now occupied by the state of Iran.
Yes.
Persia. How are Baha'i treated now in Iran, or what is their status inside that country today?
Highly persecuted. As a matter of fact, Baha'is are essentially denied higher education at the university level. Out on the table, the display table out there, is a video that I've shared there that's about the Baha'i, it's called Education Under Fire. And it's about how the Baha'i community there, what they are having to put up with, and what the response has been to it. They've gone to informal schools that help prepare students for college to go out of Iran to go to school elsewhere. And that's an ongoing thing. When the Iranian government, when they discover those schools, which are informal, they break them up and destroy them. And it's just an ongoing issue because of the hardline clerics in the Islamic faith, you know, look upon the Baha'i faith as an apostasy instead of a true religion. And so I guess from their point of view, they're doing the right thing. From, you know, a human rights international point of view, they're doing some pretty sad things. Feel free to borrow that. I put it out there for people to borrow and share around. I'd like to get it back eventually, but...
You said that your belief is that after death the soul continues to grow, and I wondered, do you have any belief in rebirth or reincarnation?
No, it's kind of a one-way journey. You don't come back to this plane of existence, as I guess is a common belief in Buddhism, you know, the recycling. It's kind of a one-way path.
Thanks. Scott Tenona here. So Baha'i teaches that humanity will be progressing and maturing, right, in both sort of kind of internal spiritual, but also in terms of economic and social justice. So, I understand the way you talk and the way Dick describes some of these things, right, it's clear that we should be, according to Baha'i, expecting future developments to be making improvements. What I'm curious about is, what kind of obligation does that give Baha'is now to be working for change? What types of things does Baha'i teach that you ought to be doing now? And how much of it is kind of on your own, just what you say and do and we're waiting, or how much are we supposed to be doing work?
It's important to interact with the world out there and try to promote the oneness of mankind. The very basic tenets of the Baha'i faith is the oneness of mankind. And to do that, there are many things. A lot of Baha'i communities around the world work at community development to help promote the equality of men and women, the conscientiousness of preserving the environment, which is very, very important, developing the human world and maintaining our physical earth in a manner that we can still live on it, etc. It's just kind of everything's kind of integrated, the whole perspective. But does that answer your question? That reminds me, as far as the environmental view, I have this little card that has a quote, and I'm a big environmentalist. And if you don't mind, I'll just read this perspective. It says, "We cannot segregate the human heart from the environment outside us and say that once one of these is reformed, everything will be improved. And man is organic with the world. His inner life molds the environment and is itself also deeply affected by it. The one acts upon the other, and every abiding change in the life of man is a result of these mutual reactions."
Christopher Renner, sort of to follow up on what Scott said, my first experience with the Baha'is was in
Europe when I was working with the International Peace Research Association. And my understanding is that traditionally Baha'is are pacifists and that...
Are what?
Pacifists.
Oh, yes.
They don't take up arms.
Right.
And that they're very committed to social justice and social change. And so maybe you could expand a little bit more about that, because I think all of us here would be very interested to hear some of the activities the Baha'is do around the world. And then just as a side note, I really like Baha'i architecture. So you might want to also make a comment about how environment in particular is reflected in the more recent structures. They're very environmentally friendly. They sort of are on the leading cutting edge of showing us how we could be doing things in some senses on that.
Actually, since I have the pictures of the Baha'i House of Worships around the world here, I think you can see that each of them is distinctive as far as architecture and unique and kind of a reflection of the environment in which it is. And the one in Santiago, Chile is just now being built. But regardless of how unique each one is, what they all have in common is they all have 9 sides and 9 entrances. And each entrance is, you know, a place where you can go in. The significance and symbology of that is the houses of worship and the Baha'i faith is open to everyone from all sides. Everyone is welcome to come in. And the services there are very, very simple. And, you know, anybody can come for a service, kind of like the UU service here, so to speak. And it just consists of readings from the Baha'i writings and from writings from the other religions, major religions, and a cappella choir singing. So in a way, it's very simple. As far as worship services, Baha'is are not to establish any types of ceremony, traditions. It's supposed to be kept very... very loose and very flexible. At the international level, we have these unique buildings. One in New Delhi, India, and this display will be up front with some of the literature that I brought to share in case anybody's interested. So you get another chance to look at it. But there are 8 international or national Baha'i temples, one on each major continent of the world currently. At the local level, usually a lot of meetings and gatherings happen in people's homes in small communities. Occasionally a community has a larger population to work with and has a, specific building that would be an equivalent of a meeting room such as you have here. And I think I kind of got off track with part of your first question. Could you
It was having to do with your social justice stance, your anti-war, what you do in other areas regarding poverty, equal rights. Just talk about some of those things you're doing.
It depends. Various communities around the world, individual Baha'is, we're encouraged to reach out and in whatever way we can interacting with organizations or starting organizations, do what we can in each country and community to further, the Baha'i ideals, the social justice, etc. Specifically, there are communities in Africa that actually have a tree planting program going. And in some, I guess it's in India, there are programs to educate women and help them to actually attain self-employment and improve their economic situation of themselves and their families and thus their communities and other such things. I don't have a lot of specific details about that. I'd have to read up on it and then pass it on to you.
The website has a lot of specific information about that.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. I left a resource sheet. I think I printed about 20 copies out there for, there's a lot of places, good resources online that you can have, you know, you can get Baha'i ebooks, or there's one for Baha'i news so you can see what's happening with the Baha'is in Iran, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, this reminds me, as far as the Baha'is in Iran, to go back to this while I'm thinking of it, one really heartening thing that's happened recently is one of the clerics in Iran have actually started advocating for acceptance of Baha'is and other religions. In other words, it's almost that we're seeing the very beginnings of maybe the tide turning, because in all the different religions, if you go to the really basic concepts, you really have the openness and acceptance of other peoples. But you get certain subsections of believers and, you know, the clergy getting a very narrow view and starting to, you know, be prejudiced against anybody who doesn't have their view. In a way, it's one of our human tendencies that, again, going back occasionally, from the Baha'i perspective, that's why religion needs to be renewed periodically, because we kind of get stuck in these back corners. That's just part of our nature. And so we need to be both, each time a new messenger, such as Abraham, Moses, Jesus, Krishna, Christ, Baha'u'llah, come, their goal is to give two different types of teachings. One is the spiritual teachings, which is basically just a reminder. The spiritual teachings are universal, and they are the same with every religion and same as given by every prophet. Those are the spiritual teachings that, you know, like the golden rule. There is a golden rule, the equivalent of the golden rule, in every major religion. And there's some examples out there, too. And then there are the social teachings, which differ depending on the needs of mankind or that portion of mankind that is being addressed by that particular prophet in the past, what their particular needs are. And these are things like, inheritance rules, these social things, you know, the more smaller, picky, everyday rules as to how you should do this, how you should do that.
I think I'm going to have to interrupt you, Sue.
Okay.
We're going to have our final song, but first I want to thank Sue very much for coming. Wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sue will stay around and answer questions for a while, won't you, Sue?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it. I feel very at home here, essentially, except for, you know, some minor details. It's a very Baha'i-like perspective and gathering here. Thank you.
For the final song, I couldn't find exactly what I wanted, so I took the liberty to compose it. The words are in your order of service. And Sylvia and I, if I can find my copy, are going to sing the first verse. Sylvia and I will sing the first verse, and then let us all, it's a very simple tune, and then let's all sing the whole song.
You balance me. We are branches.
please stand and join us. I balance you, you balance me. We are branches of one tree. We create a harmony. I am you, you are me. We are rays of one sun. We all speak with one tongue. We create a harmony. I am you. You are me. You are my voice that testifies. I see the world through your eyes. We create a harmony. I am you, you are me. I nurture you, you nurture me. We will always be one family.
For coffee.